From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, family, friends, and fans say goodbye to rapper Nipsey Hussle. Then actor and comedian Rami Youssef explores what it means to be a good Muslim in his Hulu show Rami, but the new series is not exactly a how-to guide.
Maybe someone can be like, hey, you know what you shouldn't do? What Rami did on that show. Like, even if there's like a contingent of Muslims who hate the show and use it as an example of how not to live, that's a success to me.
And Chai, the Japanese punk band that wants to redefine what it means to be cute. All that coming up on The Frame.
Podcast supported by Cinema Made in Italy and Magnolia Pictures. Dogman from the director of Gomorrah is a crime thriller that tells a story of vengeance where only the strong survive. Best Actor winner at the 2018 Cannes Film Festival. Opens April 12th in New York and L.A.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The memorial service for Nipsey Hussle was held today at a packed Staples Center. Family members, friends, and admirers took the stage to tell stories and pay homage to the 33-year-old rapper who was fatally shot on March 31st. Nipsey Hussle's real name is Armias Askadam. His father is an immigrant from the African country of Eritrea. Nipsey Hussle was killed outside the clothing store that he owned in South L.A., just part of his many investments in the neighborhood where he grew up. He also owned restaurants and had launched a program for neighborhood youth to learn about careers and technology. Austin Cross is a producer with our sister show, Take Two, and he was inside Staples Center for the three-hour-plus memorial. Austin, thanks for joining us.
Hi, John.
So, Austin, I want to ask about the mood inside the arena and the range of emotion during the ceremony.
There was such a range, and it really spoke to the variety that Nipsey Hussle had in his life in South Los Angeles. In many ways, it was a celebration. There was a DJ. There were performances. There was music. There was a lot of cheering and clapping and stomping. But then there were also these very touching moments with, the children speaking and with tears, with his mother speaking. It was a variety of things, and it was everything that really helped encapsulate who the man Nipsey Hussle was.
Karen Civil, who is one of Nipsey Hussle's business partners, read a letter from former President Barack Obama. Let's listen to what she said.
He saw a community that, even through its flaws, taught him to always keep going. His choice to invest in that community rather than to ignore it, to build a skills training center, a co-working space in Crenshaw, to lift up the Eritrean American community.
So I want to ask you about two things. One is about Nipsey Hussle as this civic leader who is really committed to helping people in his hometown. How much of the memorial was about that aspect of his life?
We definitely heard a lot about what was happening in the community, and this was in two places. First, we heard it before when we were out on the street talking to people in the line, many people coming out, some of them even with tears in their eyes, talking about the things that he did in the community. At the service, we heard from his family, and his family definitely spoke about the time before he was the rapper who's world famous, known as Nipsey Hussle, but as the man who grew up there, who experienced things just like anybody else, but who had this drive to be more, but then also to come back and to contribute to the economy and to the community. And that was a really beautiful thing. We definitely heard one thing from Snoop Dogg, who said, you know, I didn't know him when he was growing up, but he said, you got a letter from Barack Obama. You know, that's got to really mean something there.
One of the people who spoke inside Staples Center was his older brother, Samuel Askadam, and he shared stories about Nipsey Hussle's determination and drive.
While I'm trying to get money and hustling, I was in my head like, only thing we may be able to do is help get this music career going, because I felt that was the only avenue and that was the only thing he wanted to move toward.
One of the things that's remarkable about Nipsey Hussle is that he was an entrepreneur not only in the community, but also with his music. Whereas there are a lot of conversation about how he fought against labels, how he fought against preconceived notions of what kind of music he should be playing and became his own self musically.
There definitely was. And again, I come back to Snoop Dogg, because Snoop Dogg talks about the time when he listened to a Nipsey Hussle album. He said when Nipsey brought his album to him, he just said, listen to it. just listen to it. And that simple part was like, okay. Then he finally listened to it. Then he ended up doing collaborations with him. And he said the thing that stood out to him about Nipsey Hussle, he was coming with a product and he said, essentially, I've got this. This is what I'm bringing to the table. And this is how I'm going to earn my way. And, you know, he definitely did things as a businessman that people would look at and say, well, it's not very typical for a guy who's in this community, for example, selling those albums for a lot of money out of his car and things like that. But these are things that you don't really hear about. But yet he was doing it. And his brother even spoke about the fact that, you know, he would work all day for $15 and his brother would just go out. He'd come back with hundreds of dollars and say, how do you do that?
Toward the end of the ceremony, the audience heard from Stevie Wonder, and he preceded his performance with some comments about the need for gun control.
It is so painful to know that we don't have enough people taking a position that says, listen, we must have stronger gun laws. It's unacceptable.
So my final question is about the mood inside Staples Center. There is a celebration of Nipsey Hussle's life, and there's also, there has to be some sort of tragic sadness over the fact that his life was cut so short.
Well, you know, right after Stevie Wonder said that part, he said this line, he said, it's almost like the whole world is going blind. And it was really poignant coming from Stevie Wonder, of course, but it kind of speaks to the fact that some people still approach this with a big question of why. You know, of course, why did this happen to a man who was so, so very young? And when his mother spoke, you know, she said that she was at peace, she was at spiritual peace with it, and that it wasn't something that was, you know, tearing her up inside because that's just how she processes things. But even outside, there were people who were saying, you know, the system failed him. And one person put it, they said, you know, in all this darkness, the only answer that we have is to be the light, and that Nipsey was that light, and now people have to continue that life.
Austin Cross is a producer for our sister show, Take Two. He was inside Staples Center today for the memorial for Nipsey Hussle. Austin, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, John.
As often happens when an artist dies young, their music becomes even more popular. Four of Nipsey Hussle's singles landed on this week's Billboard Hot 100. As we go out, let's listen to a bit of his song, Right Hand to God. Stay with us for more of The Frame. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. 2019 already is shaping up to be a breakout year for Rami Youssef. The actor and comedian not only has an HBO stand-up special on the way, but he also has a new show called Rami. It premieres next week on Hulu. Youssef created and stars in the loosely semi-autobiographical series about a Muslim American millennial who's named Rami. He lives in New Jersey with his sister and Egyptian and Palestinian immigrant parents. The show mines some previously unexplored territory for a TV series. Yes, we see Rami struggling with work and relationships, but we also see him grapple with what it means to be a good Muslim. And since much of the series grew out of Youssef's own stand-up routine, it's also very funny. When Youssef came by The Frame Studios this week, I asked him how he first became interested in acting and comedy.
Really early on, I started making things. When I was like in middle school, I got a camera. I went to a high school that had an amazing TV program, and I just loved editing and shooting and writing. And then little by little, I was like, you know, I'd give a friend a script and I'd shoot him and I'd be like, do it like this. And then before I knew it, I was kind of acting in it. And then, you know, I moved to LA to act. But I, you know, really liked doing stage work and very quickly was doing stand up and that kind of. The stand-up has become the foundation for everything that I'm creating and doing.
When you first started doing stand-up, was it something close to what you do now, or was it a search to figure out what your comic identity would be and how close that would be to your real self?
Yeah, I feel like I hear it all the time of, like, you know, your first couple years doing stand-up, you're doing an impression of what you think a stand-up comedian is, because you have your influences, you have what you're into, and, like, you just want the crowd to be happy at first. And then slowly it just became more personal. I think once I realized, you know, my stand-up should just be very personal and should almost be a place for me to work out what I'm thinking about, work out my problems, work out those things, that being the approach that I was most comfortable with, which is not for everybody. Some people are like straight-up joke writers.
Was it most comfortable because it felt good doing it, because the audience was reacting to it? I mean, it's easy to say it's authentic, but it also has to work.
Yeah.
How did you know it was the right choice, I guess?
It was the right choice for me because I think the things that I was making personal were things people wanted to hear about. So I think that, you know, the background that I come from, my faith, my culture, all of those things, seeing the personal side of those things is something that I don't think a lot of people know anything about. And so I would just kind of like, to me, it's like, you know, I'm talking about, you know, I was fasting during Ramadan doing stand up and I start talking about it and I'm like, yeah, you know, I believe in God. And you just feel the room go, what? Like the, because, you know, most comedians' punchline is like, you know, yeah, then we go to church, right? It's like church is like a joke, you know? And so I would be like, oh, wait, that's not my reality. And very quickly I realized just talking about my reality made the crowd kind of turn their head like, oh, that's what's real to you. And so that became clear to me that, you know, all I really had to do was just talk about that stuff.
I want to play you something. It's from 2017. It's a really good moment in your professional career. You do a gig with Stephen Colbert.
My name is Rami Youssef, and I'm Muslim. Like, yeah. Yeah, like from the news. Have you guys seen our show? Fox News or any of the news is really, they're all about us. I get why people are afraid. I do, especially if you don't know a Muslim, of course. I mean, even sometimes if I watch for too long, I'm like, whoa, am I gonna do something? Like, they make it seem inevitable. I feel like no matter what I do, I'm just gonna turn 30 and get a Hogwarts letter from ISIS.
There are seeds of your Hulu series in what you said in Colbert. And I'm wondering, how did what you say in stand-up start becoming the basis for a series? And I suspect it's not a natural evolution, but it goes through steps. How did it evolve?
I was surprised at how natural it was, actually, because I realized because of the nature of it being personal and a lot of that, it jumped on screen pretty quick. I mean, I really wanted to lean on the stand-up because I knew it worked. I was like, I know this connects with people. I've been in the room with them, and I know that, you know, we can put this line in a character's mouth, or we can put the essence of this to be the subject of a scene or an episode. And so every episode started with stand-up. Our pilot is all my stand-up. Every scene is stand-up. And then as the show kind of went on, it was at least making sure every episode had a stand-up premise in it.
We're talking with Rami Youssef, who's the creator and star of the Hulu series, Rami. I want to take a listen from that pilot episode.
Yeah, I have sex even though I'm not married, and I'm probably going to try mushrooms one day. So what? Is that means I'm not a good Muslim? Like, I can't do it because I don't follow all the rules and the judgments that are always just being put on us. And then I do the same thing. I put the same judgments on everyone around me.
There's so much about what's set in this pilot, about what the whole series is about how you define what is good. What is a good son? What is a good person? What is a good boyfriend? What is a good Muslim? And I'm wondering, as you were thinking about the show and talking to writers and showrunners about what you wanted the show to be about, how did you explain what you thought its center was?
It's the question that I'm kind of constantly trying to ask myself on stage and personally in my head. You know, I mean, when we first thought of the show, I was walking around with Gerard, who EPs the show with
Gerard
me.
Carmichael from
yes.
The Carmichaels.
And we both were like, man, we both believe in God, but we've never really seen it on screen where it's not super cheesy or really on the nose or really clean, right? Because a lot of the time, like, you know, somebody is a believer and so they want to make work that adheres to the rules that they believe. But what ends up happening is you make something that is kind of disconnected from reality. So we were really excited about being like, no, what does it look like when there's this like rattling in your head of like guilt? You know, what does it look like when you're just trying to be good? And I had this stand-up joke that I would tell, you know, as Muslims, we pray on Friday, you know, and I was like, well, in my life is I love going to Friday prayers. There's Friday prayers and then there's Friday night. And that's what this show is. This show is we're seeing him really plugged in. He has this spiritual side to him. And then he goes out on Friday night and he's in that moment too. And every episode, everything exists in that space.
There are some very interesting casting choices you make in this series, and none, I think, is more important than your friend Steve Way. Steve is cast as a character named Steve, and Steve uses a wheelchair. He has muscular dystrophy. And there's a scene early in the series where your job is falling apart and Steve confronts your boss. Let's listen to this.
I mean, unless we got like a severance package or something, I'm pissed, dude.
Well, he's right there. So why did you ask him?
I don't know, he looks busy, man. I'm sure he'll send an email or something.
Oh, my God. Move.
Dude, move. Don't be aggressive.
Yo, f*** face. We're getting a severance package.
Ugh, dude, I wish. No, but you do get to keep your stock options. Which I did, well, so now that's, but there's no stock to really, so that's it. It doesn't really help at all. You know, I never said it enough, but I always appreciate the diverse perspective that you two brought to this company. Rami, with your Mediterranean flair, and Steve, every day you reminded me that things could be so much worse.
Steve has been a part of my life. You know, we've known each other since the third grade. And that high school TV program I told you about, we all started together there. It was like me, him, my friends, John and Kyle. And I always knew he could act. And I always, you know, had seen it. We made our own things. But never on, you know, a level, you know, he didn't have like an IMDb. and so, we're putting together this series. And, you know, the series is very much in this Arab Muslim community. And, you know, on any show, you're going to want a perspective from the outside. You know, you're going to want a friend who isn't that thing. And immediately I was like, well, that should be Steve. You know, like if there's going to be a quote unquote white friend or something like that. No, I want to get into this relationship that is like foundationally a big part of my life and really humanizing someone in his situation, because I think so much of the perspective is, you know, of the feeling bad. And you know, we would always joke, my friend Kyle has a joke about Steve where he says, you know, if you'd really got to know him, you probably wouldn't like him. And which is always so funny to me. Like when he said that, I was like, this is just like, yeah, we should get people to really know him and to really nuance him and nuance the relationship where no one's handling him. You know, no one is treating him differently. He is as much of a hassle as any other friend would be. And to show that dynamic was really important, I think, because then we get to really start fleshing out his desires and what he wants. And we get to question whether he should want those things.
What do you hope once it premieres people take away from the show?
I hope people have some conversations that maybe they wouldn't have had before they watched it. I think this is a family show, but I do think that families will watch it in separate rooms. I think that there is a level of awkwardness to, you know, some of the sexual stuff and just some of the more taboo things that maybe we get into. And so I couldn't, you know, I'm not trying to watch this with my parents, but I hope they watch it and then we have a conversation. And I think that what I would hate for is somebody watch this and be like, well, this is how to be a Muslim, or this is all Muslims. That's a problem, you know, because that's not what this is. But maybe this could be a reference point. You know, Ramadan's next month, and maybe people don't know how to talk about some of the things we struggle with. Maybe someone can be like, hey, you know what you shouldn't do? What Rami did on that show. Like, even if there's like a contingent of Muslims who hate the show and use it as an example of how not to live, that's a success to me. That makes it effective as a piece of art or something going out into the world, that it can be a frame of reference for something that didn't have a reference before.
Rami Youssef is the star and creator of the series Rami. It premieres on Hulu on April 19th. Rami, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh man, thanks for watching.
Coming up on The Frame, the Japanese band Chai is making body positive punk.
KPCC podcast supported by Cinema Made in Italy and Magnolia Pictures. Presenting Dogman, a sly crime thriller from the award-winning director of Gomorra. Winner of the Best Actor Award at the 2018 Cannes Film Festival and the European Film Awards. Dogman tells a story of vengeance where only the strong will survive. Official selection of the Telluride and Toronto Film Festivals and the winner of 9 Italian Oscars, including Best Picture, Director, Screenplay, and Actor. Opens Friday, April 12th in New York and Los Angeles.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Now we're going to hear from an all-girl punk band that's trying to challenge Japanese beauty standards. Chai, as in chai tea, was formed in Nagoya, Japan. Through infectious music and lyrics about body positivity, they're spreading a philosophy that they call neo-kawaii, which translates to new cute. They're currently on a U.S. tour with their new album, Punk. The Frame's Jonathan Shiflett spoke with Chai before a recent L.A. show. The four members, Yuna, Yuki, Kana, and Mana, were joined by their translator, Rena Tyner.
My name is Mana, vocal and keyboard.
My name is Kana, vocal and guitar.
My name is Yuki, I'm bass.
My name is Yuna, I'm drums.
We are Chai.
まず可愛いっていう言葉は日本にとってのビューティースタンダードで
Kawaii is actually a word used to describe Japan's beauty standards. The definition is really, really narrow. There's only a certain type of look that you can have in order to fit into that standard. We felt like that was something was wrong with that. We traditionally don't fit into those Japanese beauty standards. So for us, we actually created the word neo-kawaii to express everyone else that's not in those beauty standards. Pretty much it translates to new cute, but we are the new cute. Everybody that doesn't fit into those narrow standards of the traditional kawaii can be neo-kawaii.
Nagoya wa, Nagoya no bando wa sugoi mero.
Yeah, when we first came out, actually, Nagoya is actually known for more like a rock scene, a punk rock scene, and they still hold on to that weird scene. So a lot of underground bands are in Nagoya. We are actually very different, and when we came out, we actually were like, I mean, that's difficult to say in English, but it's pretty much, we were a band that was not above floating, but kind of floating above the others because we were so different. So we're kind of like the outsiders, the weirdos in a way. Yeah, we were the outsiders. All-girl band doing genre-less music versus like the hardcore punk rock scene that Nagoya has. So yeah, we were very different from everyone else at that time.
まずチャイはすごいファッションがとにかく大好きで、なんだろう。
We feel like fashion is really, really important to us. We do it, live it every day. As far as our fashion, the reason why we made that song Fashionista is because in Japan, there's also a weird beauty standard when it comes to fashion. As soon as one thing comes out, everybody dresses the same. But we feel like we love thrift stores. We love thrift shopping. That's all we do. Everything is a thrift store that they're wearing right now, actually. We enjoy having to create how we feel that day with our clothes, so we don't follow trends. We don't follow what everybody else wears in Japan on purpose. It's because the song is actually telling everybody you don't need to follow trends. Like, you dressing how you want to dress every single day, whether it's thrift shop, you know, clothes or whatever it is, that's what makes you a fashionista. Yuna, actually our drummer, she's a really sweet girl. She's the sweetest, she's the nicest, and she actually is the glue that holds all of us together. Yuki, our bassist, she illustrates all of our jacket photos for CDs, EPs, everything. She does all the inside illustrations, and she also is the songwriter. So we call her the most creative one.
My bass. 秘密主義
And also she's a very my pace person. So everything's my pace. So my pace and artistic.
Slow walking every day.
And she walks slow every day.
Kana はチャイの中で
So Mana again, speaking on my twin sister Kana. Kana, the guitarist, she is actually the only one who knows how to arrange chords in the group. So she does all the arranging for the music. She's also very stubborn, but in a good way. So her stubbornness actually helps develop our songs, our concept, our sound, because she's so persistent on what the sound she wants it to be. So yeah, Kana's the mama.
Mana wa.
Yeah, so this is Kana speaking on my twin sister, Mana, the vocalist. So Mana is, we call her the engine of the group. We don't really have a set leader, although we both all take different leadership roles. However, Mana is interesting because she has the loudest voice. she is the most energetic, and she's the one who actually decided on let's be a band. So she's actually the start of pretty much everything. So Mana is the engine. She is the mover. She moves the group. So this is Mana speaking on our pre-live rituals. So we have two, actually. So one, we actually tell each other really positive things. We compliment one another. And the reason being is because growing up, we actually personally always been insecure. We have a lot of insecurities. So telling each other we can do it, we're the best, we're awesome, like right before we hit the stage actually boosts our confidence so that we can give everyone the best show ever that we can do. Also, before we leave our house, we actually imagine that there are sparkles around and that you can grab with your hands the sparkles. And what we do is we throw it on top of ourselves. And that's our way of showing, like, oh, we're shining, we're sparkling, like, we can do anything. So it's a boost of confidence as well. So us doing our pre-live rituals is all about boosting our confidence and giving everybody the best show.
Thank you so much.
Chai's new album, Punk, is available everywhere. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.